previously.tv podcast network.
Listen, I'm a private investigator, Jessica Jones. You heard about what happened yesterday at the aquarium. Look, fish were hurt, people were terrorized. We just want to find the people responsible.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 195 for the week of March 12th, 2018. I am Meathead David T. Cole, and I'm here with Bourbon.com Platinum member Sarah D. Bunting.
I'll take Manhattan's.
Raging math professor Tara Ariano.
I said show your work!
And Mr. Can't pull off the leather jacket look, Kirk Hamilton.
I'm not as cool as Jessica Jones or Indiana Jones.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Extra Hot Great. Before we get into it, I just want to give you an update on the mini feed. I was expecting it to be up by now, but due to circumstances beyond my control, it is still not quite ready. But we have been recording a few minis here and there. So when it's back up, we will have a little bit of a backlog for you to enjoy. I don't want to say when it's going to be ready because I've been bitten by that before. But just know that it is still happening. You may see that the feed is up, but it may not be working 100%. So just so you know, we're still on top of it. They are still coming back. We haven't forgot about our little friends. So stay tuned on that. And with that, let's get to the episode.
Hello. Let us welcome our guest, Kirk Hamilton. Hey, Kirk.
Hello, Kirk. It's very nice to be here.
Yay! Kirk, our friend from the internet and from Kotaku, is here to join us to talk about Jessica Jones. Season 2 dropped last Thursday. 3 years, almost 2.5 years after the last season. For some reason, I had remembered it was 2016. But no, 2015 was the last time we saw her away from stupid Danny Rand and his dumb iron fist. I, for one, was happy to see her back on her own. But I had some issues with this season, starting with how much remorse do we think it makes sense for Jessica to have about killing Kilgrave in season one? Kirk, your thoughts?
I think that it's understandable that she's still sort of dealing with Kilgrave, because dealing with Kilgrave was still sort of dealing with losing her family. She's gone through a lot of stuff. I think it tracks that she would feel some remorse over that. I agree that it started to feel a little bit heavy-handed with, am I a killer? Am I not a killer? Mm-hmm. When the person that you killed was, I think, as far as I can think, the most dangerous Marvel villain I've ever heard of. So I don't know. I wouldn't feel bad about killing Kilgrave anyways.
And also, like, don't we already have Daredevil for that dithering bullshit? Like, isn't that his whole thing too? Yes? No? Yeah. Am I wrong?
Yes, I think that's fair. I think it's fair to say. I mean, I actually think that the scenes between Daredevil and Jessica Jones and Defenders, which I couldn't actually even finish, so just confession up front, I watched a lot of these Marvel Netflix shows, but I did not finish Defenders. But I like the scenes between the two of them because they kind of have a similar thing going on, you know, and it works for me. So I think it's okay if we have more than one Marvel superhero brooding about things. Mm-hmm.
My other big issue with this season was how little integration I felt there ultimately was for both Trish's whole thing and for Price Chang, this new other competing investigator that sort of mm-hmm. was in and out. Kirk, did they work? Did either of those stories work for you? And did the resolution satisfy you?
I thought that they got Trish in there in the end in a way that actually frustrated me very much. So what are we doing on spoilers here? How spoiler
can count spoilers, and then we're just going to go hog wild. So here we go.
Yeah, it's been out for, by the time this drops, it will have been out for almost a week. So people are...
Spoilers the ho, fun ahoy.
All right. Spoilers are happening. Yeah. So I thought that the way that they brought Trish in the end, having her, well, I'm just going to drop like the biggest spoiler in the whole thing, having her kill Jessica's mother, did not do much for me, given that the whole season's question was sort of about whether or not Jessica would have what it takes to kill her mother, as that became like increasingly clear that that was something she was going to have to do. So that sort of bothered me. I was also bothered by, or bother is maybe the wrong word, I didn't love how Jerry's storyline wound up kind of just never really dovetailing with what was going on in the rest of the season. I really like Carrie Ann Moss as Jerry Hogarth. I think she had a couple of the scenes that were the best, like the best performed scenes. But I didn't really, it eventually felt like she was sort of a different show running parallel to Jessica's story.
Yeah, I felt like their connection was the Malcolm of it all. And that wasn't really enough for me either. I agree with you that it seemed like a parallel, on a parallel track.
Go ahead, Kirk.
Go ahead.
Oh, it's just kind of the thing with 13 episodes, right? I feel like that's it's a recurring criticism of these shows, but having many episodes to fill, you just wind up with, in this case, a great cast with actors that I like. I really like what they did with Malcolm. I like watching these people on screen, but it just kind of wanders and stretches and everything gets stretched to thin.
I think in an episode where you can dedicate a whole episode two-thirds of the way through the season to a flashback episode about stuff we pretty much already know from context, like there wasn't a lot of new discoveries there, then I think you can safely say that your run is too long. Like, I know a couple...
I don't know if you can call Trish's bangs not a discovery. That's a discovery for me.
Well, this is a complaint that Sarah has had about almost all of the Marvel shows that we've talked about. So, Sarah, why don't you take it from there?
I didn't even get as far as the flashback episode. I think I was looking up something. Probably who was playing the mysterious other powered person that, and then, you know, like, oh, it's Janet McTeer as Alyssa Jones. Like, oh, and then it was kind of like, okay, I think I'm all set for two reasons. First of all, I was like reading a review of it, I believe by the great Alan Sepinwall, and thought that this season was 10 episodes. And when I realized it was 13 and like, I hadn't even gotten to a reveal that I knew was coming, and it was like still two episodes away. Like, I watched four episodes. I didn't dislike them, but my notes in every episode are like, can we light a fucking fire under this already?
Yeah.
Even thinking it was 10 episodes and then realizing I still had like 9 to go, I was like, you know what? In like within an episode, I'm entertained. These are very talented people. But I agree that the Chang thing like should have gone, I think, a more conventional, you know, rivals team up direction. Maybe it did. I don't know.
It definitely didn't.
I won't be finding out. Jerry was like, I feel like this sort of downward curlicue is something that we've seen many times before. And I'm not like, I assumed that she was going to sort of come back into the main story. But then even if she... You know, it sounds like she didn't. Even if she had, light a fire under it already. It just was like, why is this 13 episodes? It doesn't make any sense. Why are we having these side trips into other people's plots for extended periods of time to give Kristen Ritter a rest when at 10 episodes, you wouldn't have to do that? And that's what the money is for. Like, while I was watching a given episode, I was fine. These are attractive people doing attractive things. But then an episode would end and I was not motivated to like keep going immediately. I always found a reason to like get up and do something else. And it just, it also was too long, I think, between.
Sarah, if I may, a little maybe perhaps exercise, if you do intend to pick it back up, something that might help you get through it, which is this. Try to imagine that this is just a slightly skewed universe Gilmore Girls.
I don't know if that would work on Sarah.
No, that's not going to work on Sarah at all. Sarah will definitely never watch it again.
I mean, if you were spoiled for the mother in the season, I mean, I get it. I wasn't, and I really enjoyed it. I thought that was the point where the season kind of kicked into gear.
Well, I don't care about spoilers, like, of anyone ever. I'm the least affected by knowing stuff in advance.
Yeah.
But it was like, well, if they still haven't gotten to it after four episodes, the fuck are we doing here?
Well, it's just one of those sort of, you know, Dutch crime story red herring switcheroo moments, you know. But I suppose if you knew it from the get-go and you had to wait five episodes for that to happen, you might be twiddling your thumbs and tapping your feet. I mean, I probably would, but
Yeah,
I enjoyed that. I had been anyway.
I thought those first five episodes were a real bummer, and that it got interesting for me, like you said, Dave, when I realized what this season was actually going to be about. Because I just felt like I spent so long thinking, what the hell is this about? And compare that to season one, which, like, this, I've seen a lot of people making this comparison, and I am always careful about that kind of comparison just because everyone says the same thing. This show isn't the same without Kilgrave. But I think about that first episode of season one and the way that it began, what the first episode ended right with that girl killing her parents in front of Jessica and like relaying a message from Kilgrave to her. That was killer. I was like immediately grabbed by that and wanted to know what would happen next. This season, on the other hand, took, you know, six episodes to get to where you're like, oh, OK, I see what we're doing now. And that kind of felt pretty long to me.
Yeah, I mean. Even when, what was the, there was one of these that only had 10. Do you remember what series that was?
Is it the Punisher might not have had 13, but maybe.
Defenders only had 8. I don't know if there was one that had 10.
Okay. Anyways,
I think Luke Cage only had 10, right?
Yeah.
No.
Anyway,
Luke Cage was still too long, too. Many.
And, yeah. Marvel series are like when you go to Vegas, no matter how long you go for Vegas, it's always 2 days too long. and they just don't seem to have the ability to sort of shore it up and figure out like that optimal number. Because for me, I think like a better way, and I know it kind of goes against the Netflix grain, would actually to take an arc like this. So you have like say 12 episodes, and you know the way you do it in a comic book is you would have like four issues would comprise like a story. And the next four would comprise a story, but they're still like connected in a character arc, but they are sort of like, you know, like if we had like a fall Jessica Jones and a winter Jessica Jones and a spring Jessica Jones, where, you know, they can actually kind of have these tighter, mini arcs or whatever they call them, you know, just like a little, what do they call them? In comic books, there's a name for it when it's like a little run, I guess.
I'm not sure. I feel like I'm like failing my nerd.
Yeah. Anyways, but you know, that way, I think it'd be a little more compelling, and I think it would help the writing somewhat, where they could actually have like episode one is the start, episode four is an end of run, but not the end of the arc. I think that would help them. I feel like that exercise it could actually help the writers' room shore up this, you know, persistent Marvel TV production, you know, problem. But you know, obviously Netflix doesn't do that, unfortunately, but it is always a couple episodes too long, and it always shows. Like when they started doing this flashback episode, I was like, what? I mean, it was like so late in the game. I feel like we just saw things we already knew. And it was like, oh, okay, somebody wrote 12 episodes and needed to slip in the 13th, you know?
Well, that boyfriend stuff and the way the mom integrated, like there was some new information there. But I agree with you in general, although I would say it's not necessarily only a Marvel problem. It's a shadowy, extra-governmental, experimenting group thing. Yeah. Because it's the same problem that would happen with Orphan Black or X-Files or like any number of these where that's like... The villain is science, you know, like it just takes so long to unravel it. And by the end of it, you're like, I don't care. Like, I just want one bad guy. So
I don't know. See, that's what I enjoyed about this season, that there wasn't like, you know, the top hat, muscle twirling, cape wearing bad guy in this one. Like, you know, it was just dealing with her mom, basically. Although if science was billed as the villain, I would love the reveal of like a bunch of beakers and test tubes and bus
like a science
table.
Textbook. No.
Yeah, with like a really deep vignette. Bubbling water inside.
You know, and then there's a crossover with AP Bio. Yeah.
I appreciated that the scientist guy, you know, who created her mother and gave her powers. I believe in the comics, he's more of an unambiguously evil guy. And I appreciated that he was never really had the moment I was expecting where it turns out he's a piece of shit. Like that never happened. And he was just sort of this guy. And you had to come to your own conclusions about whether what he'd done was OK or not. I mean, it wasn't OK. And if you really look back at what he did, it was definitely not OK. And they kind of made that pretty clear in the script. But he never got a really obvious, you know, mustache twirling moment. And I actually thought that was sort of cool. And even though it, you know, it highlighted the villain problem.
I
like that too about Griffin, Trish's boyfriend, that I was, you think that he's stealing her research and he's going to
scoop
a story from her. And then it's just, oh, surprise engagement party, don't do that. But that's a nicer thing than what I thought you were doing. not a typical bad Marvel love interest guy. Good job.
Getting back to the researcher for a second. My favorite part about that character was character development through vintage rock shirts. How can we paint an immediate picture of this guy? Oh, I know. Scene one, Doors shirt. Scene two, Grateful Dead shirt number one.
Especially the Doors shirt was good because the Doors thing is so, they're hammering on the Doors literally and metaphorically throughout this show. So over and over and over, everything happens at a door, in front of a door, is about a door. And then the guy's wearing a Doors shirt. And I was like, are you serious?
Yeah, I feel like that guy, if he wasn't, this scientist that was trying to help people, that he would have been the high school guidance counselor. Like, that is that.
Yes, definitely. He like was the Freaks and Geeks guy, right?
It totally was the
guidance counselor. Mm-hmm.
I was surprised that Callum Keith Rennie got cast in something that didn't shoot in Vancouver. Good job. But also, when they were saying like someone who graduated around 1979 or the early 80s, I was like, what? He's not that old. And then I looked it up. He's 57. He looks good. I thought he was like my age.
Because he's a Cylon. They don't age. End of discussion.
Well, I have more thoughts. I was wondering if we were going to get a conscious conversation, like topic shift. I have one thought that I want to put forth about the show that I think is interesting. So they've made a lot promotionally and just like on Twitter and just in general about the fact that women directed every episode of this season. And I was noticing this before I realized that, and then, noticed it even more afterward. But I thought it was really interesting what this show did with like hot male characters versus the women, who are all beautiful as well. But this is a very, very female gaze centric show. And I thought that was really interesting. Like Malcolm, is an extremely attractive guy. The actor who plays him, Eka Darville, very good looking. The guy, J.R. Ramirez, who played her super hot dad, painter, super.
Yes.
Both of whom were kind of objectified in some ways. And I thought that was really on purpose and really interesting. And there were a lot of times where just the genders were completely flipped on things that we've seen a lot the other way. It was interesting. I thought I appreciated it.
I noticed that too. And also, like, I don't think we see a boob in this season at all, including when Jerry is having like a three hooker party.
Yeah,
like, none
true.
Of them gets totally naked at all. It's only the dudes whose butts we see. And I appreciated that also.
Yeah, it was interesting. There was one scene where Jessica goes, I'm trying to remember why she was trying to get information from this guy. There's the guy at the country club. And she goes, they go into this all-man country club, and then she's sort of threatening this guy, trying to get, I think, information on the doctor. And then she goes and finds his son and holds him up on the wall and takes a picture and is basically telling this guy's dad that she's going to kill his son or beat his son up. And I was imagining that scene, and I was imagining that scene with the genders flipped. Like, what if a male protagonist had done this to a woman he was interrogating and gone and gotten her daughter and held her up against the wall? And it sort of like really highlights how much context matters and why what they're doing is so sort of electric and interesting. Because that scene, I was like, man, like that is a really messed up thing for anyone to do. But the differences between the two things I thought were very interesting.
Yeah.
Tara, do you have anything to say about Patty's wardrobe?
Oh, Trish just has her wardrobe is on point this season. I was very happy with all of her outfit choices. You can find a lot of them on, I'll look it up. It's like wornontv.com has a lot of sourcing information. But yeah, I feel like the people who dress Marvel women on these Netflix shows like really have fun making them look amazing because they all live in New York. They're all supposed to have money and they all like every outfit is on point except Jessica. So I feel like they probably get bored just putting her in like a white t-shirt or a black t-shirt or a gray t-shirt. And so they put a lot of energy into making Jerry and Trish look especially fun and interesting.
Except for maybe Trish's circus ringmaster outfit from about halfway through the season. It was like
that red crop jacket with the black lapels was a rare fail for Trish. But the rest of the time, I thought she was showing a lot of color. Great necklace in that first episode with all the loops. Yeah. Good looking out for
how sweaty is Jessica Jones running around in her getup in the height of summer? In
maybe that's one of her superpowers, is that she needs to drink more booze and she sweats less. Maybe those are both sort of unlisted benefits.
I don't know. I had problems with Kilgrave as a villain in the first season. So having season two kind of be villainless in that way anyways, except for, you know, the concept of science run amok and whatnot, but having the mom sort of be, you know, a gray villain anyways, you know,
like an antagonist, yeah, if not a villain, right?
I really enjoyed that part of it. I thought that her character was fun in a gleeful sort of lawful evil kind of way. Mm-hmm. And I agree that these were always too long, but I really did enjoy it. Like, Jessica Jones is by far my favorite of these series.
For sure. Me too.
It was. We'll see what Luke Cage does, but
right.
Yeah, yeah. It was fun for me to watch the mom because she was getting mad about stuff that I agreed with her. And so it was a lot of glancing over at Dave being like, is this what it's like living with me? Like when she's yelling at the cab driver to quit texting while he's driving or whatever. But yeah, I thought they got at some interesting stuff in terms of like her manipulation of Jessica and how their relationship was, you know, at the end getting to be very codependent, like leaving aside the whole, will she have to kill her or not question? Like, you know, putting it on Jessica, like, you're the only one who can keep me grounded. You were, you know, you helped me to calm myself down. And even Carl couldn't do that, whatever. Like, that's not good mothering. That's not good friending. That's not good being in a relationship thing. Mm-hmm. And I thought the show made that very unambiguous in terms of where it stood on that question. Anyway.
And the other thing about the mother arc that I not enjoyed, but I appreciated, is how often in a movie or a TV show, do you have a really important character dispatched as they would be in real life? Like, it was just da 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 gunshot dead. It wasn't da 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 gunshot dead. I have 20 seconds for a last message to my daughter.
Yeah,
as I,
yeah.
You know, put my palm on her face and slowly fade away. Like, it was just done. And that is something that you don't get written into a TV show a lot. And, you know, that sort of, you know, lack of closure, you know, maybe something that comes back on in season three. I would doubt it.
Probably. Dave, I'm curious. You said you didn't love some things about Kilgrave. What did you think of Kilgrave's episode where he turned up as head Kilgrave and talked to Jessica?
Yeah, I thought that maybe that was kind of more fan service and story service. I think we had a fine sense of what demons are going through Jessica Jones' head without needing British narration on the whole thing. So I could have done without it, but like, I don't think it's particularly weaker with it in. I mean, I suppose maybe somebody was worried that, you know, we don't have a capital V villain here. It would be nice to remind people that, you know, we do have superheroes and therefore supervillains are still running around in our universe, even if they're just running around in Jessica Jones's head. But overall, I thought it was a little convenient.
It's funny because there's, so the video game Batman Arkham Knight, there are all these like Arkham Batman games.
Yeah.
And in that game, Joker is in Batman's head for the whole game. And it's so similar the whole time. I kept like it. They did so many things with like the same things with the camera. And he's always coming in. He's even doing the same taunt. He's trying to get Batman to kill someone. And the whole time I just kept thinking, man, this is just like watching an episode of Arkham Knight. But I think Arkham Knight did it better. So, you know, whatever.
I just want to say I tried really hard to get a video game themed game time for your appearance here, but it's going to be one week too late. So you don't.
Oh, have that's fine. I'm sorry.
Any other closing thoughts on Jessica Jones before we move on?
Sarah, I think you should finish the season at some point when you have time, if that ever happens. I don't think you will regret spending the time. It's, you know, it is too long, but I think it ends in a satisfying way.
Yeah, it's just one of those things where it was like, if I don't have to continue, then I'm just not gonna continue. So yeah, I'm probably not gonna continue, but we'll see.
Yeah, I do think that it got better as it went. I was really worried after four or five episodes, and it wound up being pretty mixed on it, but I was glad I watched the whole thing just because it did get better as it went.
I didn't hate the flashback episode as much as Dave either.
I didn't hate it.
No.
I just thought
Rachel Taylor as young Trish was amazing. I thought she did a really good job.
Me too.
Yeah, I didn't hate it. I just thought it was emblematic of these shows being too long. And generally,
no, I get it, but...
if somebody said, well, now you got a 12 episode order, I know which one to cut. It is time to go around the dial. Our first stop, Tara Ariano.
Hello, I'm here to tell you that you should watch Champions. This is the new show from NBC's Thursday night sitcom lineup. It will air after Will and Grace. It's created by Charlie Grandy, a former writer on The Mindy Project and Mindy Kaling. And it revolves around Michael Patel, who is a gay boy who's on his way to a performing arts school in New York from his home in Cleveland, where he's been raised by his single mom, Mindy Kaling. And something fell through with his housing. And so in order for him to go to the school, I want to call her Mindy. That's not her name. Priya, the Mindy character, decides the only way it can happen is if he goes and lives with his biological father, who he's never met and who is played by Anders Holm, also from The Mindy Project, formerly Workaholics as well. And he's sort of a slack ass who runs a gym with his brother, Matthew. And the kid is not what the dad thought he wanted, and the dad is not what the kid thought he wanted. But by the end of the first episode, they come to a kind of peace. But even in the outro, over the closing credits, like, the kid is still complaining about all the ways the dad has let him down, and kind of calls back to an earlier point in the episode where Priya says that raising him has been the most wonderful adventure of her life until he turned 4 and saw Bernadette Peters singing Send in the Clowns on PBS and started complaining nonstop that he needed to go and live in New York. So he's that kind of kid. He's played by J.J. Toda, who broke out initially in the movie Other People a couple of years ago, the Molly Shannon mom cancer dying movie, and where he also played an extremely dramatic gay kid. And he is, I mean, he's got to be the reason this show exists. Like, it's such a star vehicle for him. He is so funny and smart and good and, like, unselfconscious and great, and sings We Are the Champions, accompanying himself on piano for his audition to this performing arts school. It's really charming and cute. The dad has a brother named Matthew who's also runs the gym with him, who's like a cute dummy, and he and the kid like each other more than the dad and the kid do. But it could fall down on cliche in a lot of different ways, but it doesn't. It's really good, and the kid is pure magic. Not since Bobby J. Thompson have I loved a child actor this much. So Champions, NBC, 9:30 on Thursdays. Check it out. I think you will like it. And for my plug, since I just mentioned it, Will and Grace back on Thursdays, and Will and Grace and Kevin and Tara back on Thursdays as well. This week's episode dropping tomorrow as you're listening to this, Will's long ago legendary ex Michael is back, and they decided to just recast the actor who had previously played him before, which they're doing with a whole bunch of roles this season, and I'm not happy about it, so we will be talking about it on the next podcast.
Kirk, it is your turn.
All right, well, I am plugging, or I am promoting, sort of mixed on, a show called Altered Carbon that's on Netflix now. And it's been up for, I think, a couple months maybe, but I only just watched it maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago. It is a sci-fi noir mystery story starring Joel Kinnaman, who people might know from The Killing.
We talked about him.
Did you guys have you talked about Altered Carbon?
Dave talked about it today.
Not the show, just the fact that Joel Kinnaman is the lead. But please continue.
Well, so now I feel like I'm walking into a trap, but let me just tell you that I think he's surprisingly good on this show.
Whoa! And,
he's okay. So he's this huge meat slab of a guy. Let me back up. I'm gonna describe what the show is about first. So this is a show where it's based on a book by, I want to say, Richard K. Morgan, and it's a sci-fi, you know, world way in the future where people have stacks that their consciousness is downloaded into, and it's like this little chip that you have in the back of your neck. So death no longer really means anything because your consciousness is in this little chip. So you can put it into any body. People call a body a sleeve. And so you look one way for 100 years and then your sleeve gets blown away. They take your stack out, put it in somebody else. You can be somebody else. That's basically the premise. And this show is extremely like porny and tawdry and ridiculous. I started watching it thinking I was not going to like it. It's a visual mashup of everything. Just The Matrix meets Blade Runner. It doesn't seem like it has a new idea to offer. But the more I watch it, I finished the first episode and just kind of found myself thinking, I kind of want to know what happens next. And I kept watching. And over time, I was won over by this show. By the end of the season, I thought, for starters, the story really came together well. There's a good mystery at the heart of it, I thought. And it resolves in a way that I thought was interesting. It has a good cast. It features Renee Elise Goldsberry, who played Angelica Schuyler in Hamilton. And she's really, really good in it. And actually, Joel Kinnaman. So this guy is just this slab of meat. He's like ridiculously ripped, giant man who plays everything really, really low key. And yet he spends half of the show walking around with this pink, like Hello Kitty backpack full of guns. There's something about the way that they've written his character and he performs it that I actually wound up finding very appealing. it's a weird show. It's like I said, it's very porny. It's very violent. It looks very expensive. So it's sort of just fun to watch something that looks like it costs a whole lot of money to make. And I was surprised to like it as much as I did because I didn't think I would.
Yeah, I watched the first few episodes and the look of it kind of reminded me, like the whole place takes place in the Toy Master room from Blade Runner. Like it was very grimy,
exactly.
Very Blade Runner-y, obviously. So my problem with Joel Kinnaman is that he is a charisma black hole. Like, and a few people have argued to me that like that is the character. He's just like this super stoic, you know, has lived too long. Is now, you know, he's unfrozen caveman lawyer character now. He's been frozen for 100 years or something like that. He's brought back. And that's just the way he was written. That said, a lot of times TV people, they make changes to characters to make them more appealing or at least more watchable. And I don't know whether it's the character that bothered me that way, or I'm pretty sure it's Joel Kinnaman because he acts the same way in everything he is, which is barely, like whether it's House of Cards, I'm going to assume RoboCop. I didn't have the heart to watch RoboCop with Joel Kinnaman. And this show, he just sort of feels like he's sleepwalking through a lot of it.
What's interesting about that is that he's not actually the guy, right? In this show, he is not. There's this other version of him. He's a guy named Takeshi Kovacs, I believe is his name. And there's another guy who is played by a different actor, and you see him in flashbacks. And I think they've said in the next season it's going to be about that guy or some other guy. So they actually can recast this show very easily. You know, if someone doesn't like an actor or something doesn't work out, which I think is like an interesting facet of the lore of this world they've built.
Yeah.
Now I hope that everyone is played by Kinnaman, including ladies. And then we can make Dave watch it and ask if it's worse than Jazz. Is this worse than Joel?
That's a good question.
Well, when it came out, I said, man, the show I wanted was the original sleeve, as you're saying, like the in the apartment flashback or whatever that was. That was like that guy I liked. And then he is suddenly in Joel Kinnaman's sleeve. I'm like, oh, come on. So anyways, but you're right. Like this show it's incredibly derivative, but it's beautiful to look at. And I was sort of interested in the story. I really dug Edgar Allan Poe hotel.
He's great. The artificial intelligence hotel.
Yeah, that was kind of fantastic. And it kind of reminded me a bit of like the John Wick Continental setup. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's definitely some John Wick going on in the show in general, too, in some of the action scenes.
So, yeah, it's on my list of things to pick up when it gets back slow. But it's interesting that that Joel Kinnaman worked for you and he doesn't work for me. I was saying
it like, was surprising. I didn't see it coming either, but I wound up liking him in the end.
Netflix, another Netflix triumph.
So I guess I get to do a plug too. Can
absolutely
I plug something?
Yeah.
Oh man. You're okay. So man. I, in addition to coming on this beautiful podcast, I host a podcast called Kotaku Split Screen, where we mostly talk about video games. We've got a bunch of stuff coming up over the next 2 weeks. We're going to be at South by Southwest this week. I've never been to South by Southwest. Woo! I hear it's terrible, but I guess excited. We're going to do a live show from there.
It's going to be better than E3 though.
Well, yes, I think so. Well, we're going to the Game Developers Conference the week after that, and that is awesome because that's just a bunch of people who make video games, and you get to talk to them about.
I apologize, I haven't listened to video game podcasts in ages because I've sort of fallen out of.
They're all bad, and it's totally understandable.
But is it a co-op based?
Our podcast, yes, is it's two of us, me and my co-host Jason Schreier, best reporter in the industry. And so we just talk about kinds of stuff. There's going to be, we have a lot of other people coming on the show, though, over the next 2 weeks. So check out Kotaku Split Screen if you are at all interested in video games.
And we'll locally in San Francisco, you can be found at jazz clubs everywhere.
Actually, I'm in Portland now. But I can be found in jazz clubs in Portland now.
Wow. Jazz clubs in Portland.
There are a few. There's like two or something.
All right. I'm sorry. I may have spoken over it. That's Split Screen is the name of the podcast.
That is correct. All
right. Sarah D. Bunting.
So CBS All Access's The Good Fight has returned. I have seen the first three episodes of this season. I am not 100 on this whole Diane has a dark night of the soul that leads her to experiment with microdosing thing. Because I feel like it's about to, exactly, it's about to become a capital T thing. But otherwise, it's a delight to have it back. Not least because I think that the whole Paul Guilfoyle parental Ponzi thing has finally gotten wrapped up. Hopefully never to be seen again. It always felt very kind of aughts and tired and a waste of Bernadette Peters, speaking of. But now we have Rob Reiner as a snarky judge. Marissa is getting more to do and getting a love interest. Christine Baranski and Audra McDonald go out drinking together. It is great. This might not be the must-seeest TV in subscription service history, but for fans of The Good Wife, whose main issue with the show was The Good Wife herself, this is like, it's perfect. They use everyone perfectly and talk about wonderful outfits. They're great. It's gorgeous to look at, and it doesn't think people have to be 25 and or white to be interesting and compelling. So I am into it, and I was like, I don't know if I'm going to subscribe again. I don't know, but it's just such a satisfying show. It sets out to do a thing. It does it. Christine Baranski swears and has perfect hair. What else is there to say? So I hope everyone else is back on board as well.
What shows does CBS All Access have besides this and Star Trek Discovery? Like, is
this the only two I know of?
They have some, other things.
They have stuff in development that the Jordan Peele Twilight Zone is going to be on.
Oh, is it?
But I don't think anything else is current.
It's kind of funny how CBS All Access, I mean, with the exception of The Good Wife, Good Fight, seems to be a dumping ground for things they would be scared to put on CBS. Like, this isn't a procedural about cops or old men solving mysteries. We better put it on CBS All Access. It's like the Taking Chances version of CBS.
Was The Good Fight like a chancy? So I was a big fan of The Good Wife. I think I stopped watching it season 5. There's some point where it gets bad and then I stopped. But it was really, I loved that show. Is The Good Fight a risky seeming show? I would think a spinoff of a very successful show wouldn't be risky.
It has boobs and F words.
That's risky. I feel like that's definitely risky these days.
Well, and there's also she goes to work for a black firm or a majority black firm. So maybe that would be part of the calculation as well of like, we don't want this to be the Rachel Bachelorette season of a CBS procedural with like too many not white people. So I don't know if that's if that was part of it too.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure what their calculation was, but I don't know. I think that they should start transitioning some of this stuff onto the actual network because eventually their viewership is going to start dying in huge chunks.
Yeah, it seems that way.
Because it's all 85-year-olds. And my parents,
a pitch, and God, I would love to see this happen just generally across the board. I'm sure it won't because people can make more money off infomercials. But what if like every network took stuff that was on their exclusive, online content platforms and like gave it 3 months, gave it 6 months, whatever. And then that was their midnight programming. Like now, today, this weekend, you could start watching the beginning of Star Trek Discovery on terrestrial TV. And it'd be like every network has like their Adult Swim-ish sort of like, this is a little off brand for us, but you know, here it is, you know, like something like that would be interesting. I guess terrestrial TV is always being downgraded these days. I doubt they're going to, you know, ever prop it up, but there's something like CBS Access. I just don't understand like who is subscribing. I mean, we're the exception because we sort of have to have all these services, but like if I was just a consumer, like I would order CBS All Access for 9 weeks or whatever the Discovery run was and then immediately cancel it until it came on again. Cause there's got like three shows on that thing. It's just, such a weird embryonic offering. I don't understand, you know, how that works for them.
Yeah. It doesn't make much sense to me either. It's interesting. The way you guys talk about this is I'm not a professional TV critic, but I am a professional game critic. And I like pay for all these video game subscription services. Yeah. That I definitely wouldn't pay for, you know, Xbox Live and PlayStation Plus and whatever else, EA Access. And I wouldn't pay for any of those. And I'm actually looking at the TV thing a little bit more from the perspective of just a civilian. And I definitely, you know, I wanted to watch Star Trek Discovery. My girlfriend and I are big Star Trek fans, but I haven't watched it yet because, like, I already pay for Hulu and Netflix and, you know, HBO Go. And it's there's definitely a threshold past which I'm not willing to go.
It's interesting that for the longest time, all the cord cutters, like their battle cry was a la carte. And now you're getting a la carte and it costs more than cable, Yep. Like it's like, did you not see this coming? Like it was super obvious that there is not going to be one centralized service from which you can buy a la carte shows. It's going to be every single network, studio, whatever is going to have their own half-baked option that you have to subscribe to. And nobody's going to be less than $5 a month. Most are going to be like $10 a month. And then like, if you know, they have one show, this guy has two shows you watch, this guy has three shows, you add them all up and you're paying the same as you would for cable. You know, if you're actually going to watch all this stuff, it's good for the people that only have three shows on TV they watch, but that's not usually the case for the kind of people that are grousing about this kind of thing.
There's also just the cost of how much time it takes to do all of that. I'll think, oh, I want to watch The Americans, but okay, I don't have FX. So if I get that on Amazon, then the season costs this much money. But would that cost as much as if I waited for it to come to Netflix and I'm paying this much per month for Netflix? And you have this whole spreadsheet and eventually it's like, I don't have time for this. I just, I have a job.
Yeah. A hot tip if you're ever looking to discover all these services that you auto pay for and you kind of forgot because you stopped watching, there is a website called Trim. And you can subscribe to it and just give it access to, I think, I forget what you have to give it access to. But anyways, it goes through
your social security number.
Not that, but it's something, it might be your credit card receipts. But it goes through there and figures out what all your reoccurring auto charges are and then lets you know.
I feel like that would be galling just to see the number, the amount of money I'm spending yearly on all of these different services.
Exactly. All right. Sorry, Sarah.
No, I was done. That's fine. I guess I'm plugging Trim. Just kidding. I'm actually plugging The Blotter, which is previously.tv's True Crime on TV podcast. We're actually doing a little book club this week with my guest, Mike Dunn, because there is a Golden State Killer four-part special that aired last week on Investigation Discovery. We'll be talking about that in conjunction with reviewing Michelle McNamara's book, which finally dropped for civilians last week or the week before. Again, it's about the Golden State Killer, and this was Patton Oswalt's late wife and web mistress of True Crime Diary, who was obsessed with this case and died unexpectedly a couple of years ago before she could finish the book. I have now finished the book, and we'll be talking about that. So if anyone else is speed reading it right now, we would love for you to listen. And we would love to hear from you on the forums. That's forums.previously.tv. That's it.
All right. Since we have Kirk here, the author of what we're about to talk about. I want to get the definitive answer, the definitive meta answer on this question.
Okay.
Is this worse than jazz?
Now, oh man, memories.
A little background. Once upon a time, I asked a very young Kirk Hamill to write me a theme for an idea I had for a segment called Is This Worse Than Jazz? Because we all know Dave Cole hates jazz. And we would compare jazz to something terrible that's happening on TV and determine whether, in fact, it was worse than jazz. So I go to Kirk Hamilton and I say, Kirk Hamilton, can you whip me up something that is terrible, hateful, you freeform jazz? And he's like, yeah, I guess I can do that. Flash forward to 2 or 3 months and I discover that Kirk is actually a accomplished jazz musician and I probably just insulted the living hell out of him for the past 3 months. That said, we're still friends, we're still talking, so phew. But now that we have you, finally have you on the show, I want to ask you, is the theme you were forced to create, or is this worse than jazz? Worse than jazz, and you may qualify that any way you wish.
Okay, this is a good question. I think it's worse than good jazz. So, yes, in that sense it is. I think that it is. I think all jazz is worse than jazz in one way when you think about it. And I also would just like to say that part of being a jazz musician is having a sense of humor about jazz. And just because you kind of have to, there is a lot of bad jazz.
You're the one who thinks that. Okay.
Yeah, it's important. I mean, I guess it's like anything, right? It's helpful to have a sense of humor about whatever your craft is, whatever it is you went to school for and learned how to do. And jazz is no different. It's really funny hearing that track. I haven't heard that first part in a little while. It's kind of rocking. It's brought the thunder.
It is my
on
favorite segment clip on this show by far. Every time
it does just keep going. It's so good.
Yeah.
It's so good about
forever.
What is bad about jazz. It's great.
And it's just trying to be as insipid and good as possible.
So for the record, the theme to Is This Worse Than Jazz is in fact worse than jazz.
So, man, there it is. I can just see the sax solos now.
There we have it. Thank you very much, Kirk, for that determination and for the theme.
You're welcome.
It is one of our great treasures. All right, everybody, it is time for the canon, and I believe in an extra hot great first, back-to-back submissions from the same submitter, Laura.
Really?
Yes.
Oh,
All right. Didn't really plan it this way, you know, because when we have a guest, we let the guest choose from our hopper of user submitted canons to see what they might want to hear an argument for. And these submissions were sent in half a year apart or so. So it's kind of interesting. So, but with that, let's let Lauren take it away.
Hi, Dave, Tara, Sarah, and special guest. Today I'm submitting to the canon Season 2, Episode 4 of BoJack Horseman, titled After the Party. In my opinion, this episode is a perfect encapsulation of what the show does well. Visual gag with a pretty high hit rate, staunch commitment to bits, and one of the most unwavering looks at depression that I have seen portrayed on television. This episode in particular provides some really quotable bits and nice character moments. The show opens on Mr. Peanut Butter and Diane returning home from a day out for Diane's birthday, including an event, Women on the Wall, an exploration of gender in text and media, Barbara Kruger and Jenny Holzer in conversation with Helen Molesworth, say that 3 times fast, a title whose gag plays off a few times during the episode. On returning home, the following on-the-nose foreshadowing takes place.
I loved everything about today. Thank you.
So there's nothing else you want?
No. All I want now is to get into bed, listen to Prairie Home Companion, and snuggle up to my wonderful husband.
You don't want anything else?
No. Today was perfect. Any additional thing would be overkill.
Okay. If you say so.
Surprise!
Oh, my God.
And, of course, behind the door, there is a surprise party waiting for Diane. After the credits, the situation picks up later in the night mid some unspecified fight that we later learn is about whether or not Tony Curtis is dead. He died in 2010.
He's
dead! I told you he's dead! Why don't you ever listen to me? He is dead, goddammit!
One of the things I appreciate about this episode is that the inciting fight isn't about something big. It's a silly thing that isn't about what it is. And it's a fight I think every couple has. My husband and I have taken to ending those kind of tiffs with, I know things, goddammit. The party awkwardly breaks up, and from here, the episode follows three couples. Princess Carolyn and Todd, and Vincent Adultman, Bojack and Wanda, and Mr. Peanut Butter and Diane, through the rest of the night. Each vignette is a showcase for the characters and the relationships they found themselves in. We start with Princess Carolyn and Todd, and the always delightful, never quite overused Vincent Adultman. Driving Todd home, Princess Carolyn sees a child that looks just like Vincent walking with his mother down the street. Of course, Princess Carolyn reaches the only conclusion that makes sense, that Vincent has a secret family and kid. Carolyn and Todd head to her house, and Vincent comes to the door. Drama ensues.
Princess Carolyn!
Oh my God, that's him! Quick, jump out the window, shimmy down the drain pipe, and wait in the car!
What?
Vincent has a terrible temper. He throws tantrums. If he finds you in my apartment, who knows what he's capable of? But also, stay close, because if he finds me alone, who knows what he's capable of?
Fine. You're lucky I love shimmying.
And I love the throwaway line from Todd. You're lucky I love shimmying. At the door is Kevin, Vincent Adultman's son. What follows is a really silly string of visual gags of Kevin and Vincent being at the same place, but not really being at the same place, and it being really obvious that Kevin is three little boys in a trench coat and Carolyn just not getting it. A favorite exchange of mine.
Kevin, what grade are you in? Kevin? Now, where did he go?
He was getting on my nerves. Children.
Well, I got this snack for him.
Right. Could you turn around for a second?
What? Why?
Because you have such a pretty figure.
Well, that's true. Okay.
All of this farce culminates in a revelation from Princess Carolyn.
What are we doing?
Being grown-ups?
You know, when we first met, I was looking for something in my life, and I wanted it so badly that I made myself believe you were it. But I think that wanting to believe something isn't the same as something being real. And this isn't real.
What are you saying?
I think it's time we stop pretending.
I love how, though Vincent is clearly a joke, Princess Carolyn's emotions are not, and her feelings are taken seriously. And this shows some real character growth. Vincent works as a metaphor for being in a relationship that you really want to work, but knowing your gut isn't right. While this is going on, Todd is in the car with Princess Carolyn's work and personal phones. The phones get a bug that allow them to experience love, and it turns out that Princess Carolyn's work phone is in love with her personal phone.
Todd?
Yes, phone?
Are we in love?
No,
Todd's phone, but I am in love. With you.
What?
Princess Carolyn's work phone. I never knew.
How could you? All this time, I have loved you from afar.
We are from two different worlds.
What is happening?
Todd, will you make us kiss?
What?
Make us kiss, Todd. We want to be kissing.
We must do kisses to each other, Todd.
At the end, the personal phone decides to update her operating system to get rid of the love bug because to feel love is to feel pain. This bit of business is pretty silly and really surreal, but its brevity and commitment make it work. The vignette is best surmised by Todd. Love is weird. Next, we move on to Bojack and Wanda. This is probably the weakest section of the episode, so I will keep it brief. Bojack and Wanda leave the party and head home. Bojack, being Bojack, starts an unnecessary fight.
Look, what happened back there is not your fault. That's just what happens when two people live together.
That's a weird thing to say to your girlfriend who just moved in with you.
Do you think maybe we're going too fast?
Oh, I get it. Okay, so your friends got in a big fight, and that means we have to get in a big fight.
I don't want to get in a fight. Just, we moved in together without really giving it much thought.
Yeah, it was your idea, and it's been great.
Sure, it's great now, but it could be not great later, and I feel like I'd be a bad boyfriend if I didn't prematurely freak out about that. I mean, what is this?
I don't know. It's been 2 weeks. Let's give ourselves some time before we rush to judgment.
Wanda diffuses the situation with a joke. Forgive me for the long clip, but you kind of need to hear all parts for it to pay off.
Can I tell you a joke?
Sure.
Okay, so there's this gardener, right?
Ugh, is this a joke about nature?
Could you just listen?
Okay, okay.
So, the amazing thing about this gardener is that he always knows exactly how many bags of mulch he needs for a job, just by looking. Like, he gets it right every time. He's the best. So one day, he looks at a yard he's working on, and he's like, 18 bags. So he goes to the store, buys 18 bags of mulch, and goes to work. And when he's finished, the flower beds are amazing. Beautiful roses, beautiful lilies. Beautiful
orchid bushes.
Well, you wouldn't really have a bush of orchids.
I'm sorry, I thought you said this gardener was the best.
Okay, fine. All right, beautiful orchid bushes. But there's one problem. He still has one bag of mulch left. He can't believe it. This has never happened before. Well, the extra bag of mulch drives him crazy. He's the guy who always gets the right amount of mulch. He's like, ah, extra mulch. Oh, no. So on the drive home, he throws the bag of mulch out the window over the side of the 101.
And?
Well, that's it. He throws it out the window.
That's the punchline?
That's kind of a thinker.
I'll say. Makes me think you forgot the rest of the joke.
No, no. Oh, just picture it. He's on the 101, and he throws the bag of mulch out over the side of the freeway.
Oh, I got the narrative. That wasn't the source of my confusion. The confusion was more about the joke not being funny.
Why does everything always have to be funny?
Everything doesn't always have to be funny. Just jokes.
BoJack quibbles about the story being a story instead of a joke, but before BoJack can torpedo his relationship further, he hits a deer in camo gear with a car. They chase the deer into the woods and convince him to go to the hospital. There's some business about the deer being a metaphor for BoJack and his fears, but it's a bit on the nose for my taste. At the hospital waiting room, Wanda tells another joke.
So, there's this couple who just started dating, and things are going really well. One day, the girl finds a box of old love letters from her high school boyfriend. She reads them and, like, loves how silly they are, you know, the drama of young romance. So, on a whim, she sends the letters to her ex-boyfriend, thinking he might find them funny, too. Well, okay, that night, she tells her current boyfriend about it, and he loses his shit. They get in a huge fight about it. He's all, "Why would you send your ex the old love letters? He's going to think you're still in love with him." And she's just like, "Relax, Brandon."
Is the boyfriend's name Brandon?
Yeah, that's the new boyfriend. I forgot to mention that, but it doesn't matter. So anyway, now the night is ruined because Brandon is obsessed. He's like, "That ex-boyfriend's going to come back for you. He knows where you live." So after dinner, he drives her home. She lives in one of those big apartment buildings by the freeway, and he walks her to her door, but he forgets to lock the car and leaves the windows down. He kisses her goodnight, but things are kind of weird, you know? Then he gets back in his car and starts to drive away, but when he glances in his rearview mirror, his blood turns cold. Guess what's in the back seat?
The ex-boyfriend?
No, the bag of mulch!
What? Oh, wow, that is actually a really good joke.
I told you, some things take time.
As a character, Wanda didn't always work for me, but in this episode, she serves as a good foil to BoJack, if clearly someone who is way too good for him. It outlays pretty clearly what BoJack would need to do to make this relationship work and why he probably won't be able to do that. Finally, we return to Mr. Peanut Butter and Diane. They pick up on the ever-important issue of Tony Curtis's mortality, and the argument goes broader, as it often does.
Why, you couldn't just believe that I know something!
I believe you know lots of things! I just thought, what's the harm in checking? Especially since we have these amazing little boxes now with 24-hour access to the world's largest source of information!
You shouldn't have to check whether or not your wife knows what she's talking about. You humiliated me in front of all my friends! You can give it a rest. Show's over.
Okay, but don't I get a little bit of credit for inviting all of your friends to an awesome surprise party?
No, because why did you think I would want an awesome surprise party?
Is it the awesome part you object to, or...
You always just assume that everyone wants whatever you want. Well, you know what they say about assuming. Makes an ass out of you and Ming.
Who's Ming?
Diane is pissed that Mr. Peanut Butter didn't know her well enough to know that she wouldn't want a surprise party, and Mr. Peanut Butter is annoyed that his wife doesn't appreciate a genuinely nice thing he did for her. It's a kind of fight common to marriage. Neither is right, neither is wrong, but they both have a lot of righteous anger.
Sorry, I threw you an amazing party!
You didn't throw me an amazing party. You threw you an amazing party. Everything today has been about you!
Really? That picnic we had in the tea garden was about me. That trip to the library was about me. We Women on the Wall, an exploration of gender in text and media, Barbara Kruger and Jenny Holzer in conversation with Ellen Molesworth was about me? Oh, sure, fine. Just walk away.
Whoa, ow!
And because it's Mr. Peanut Butter, Diane walks into her bedroom where there's a ball pit. The tension is diffused more or less as Diane struggles to make herself feel heard and not crazy. The party includes a Starbucks room and a jello-filled pool where they end up talking. And then the fight under the fight under the fight appears.
We only have so many days together. I want everyone to be a happy one.
Oh my God. You don't want me to go to Cordovia.
What?
You don't think I know what it means when you say shit like, we only have so many days together?
What?
Diane, I love waking up next to you. Diane, I wish every day could be like this.
Yeah, but...
just the two of us together. Do you have any idea how that feels when I'm trying to plan my trip?
Okay, you got me. Maybe I don't want my wife... whom I love, to go off on a terrifying six-month tour of the most war-torn, disease-splattered corners of the planet with a charming, handsome, billionaire bachelor? What can I be thinking? I'm such a terrible husband!
I'm not happy!
The two are able to have a real conversation about Diane's unhappiness and feeling of driftlessness, and are able to come to a conclusion.
Do you know what I do while you're at work all day? I mostly just sit right there. Sometimes I pretend to dig a little hole and then I take a nap. And when I hear your car in the driveway, it is the best part of my day. I mean, I go insane.
I know. And I love you so much. But you're never going to be my only priority like that. That's just not how I'm wired. I need to also live my life.
Well, okay.
Is it okay if I change and try new things and you still love me? And you just stay the same person you've always been and I still love you?
Yeah, that sounds good to me. Does that work for you?
Yeah, I think that works. Just don't throw me any more surprise parties, okay?
Yeah, noted.
The two run off to play in the ball pit and poor Paul McCartney jumps out of the cake with no one to greet him. I have to admit, I'm a Mr. Peanut Butter enthusiast, and I love him and Diane together. Above all, this is a couple that you believe love each other, and you believe their struggles are real. Altogether, I think this is a really funny episode of television. It takes a nuanced look at relationships in three different stages, and even with a somewhat weak second section, I think this episode is canon-worthy because it shows some of what the best that BoJack Horseman can do in terms of character building and storytelling. And there's just a lot of funny stuff in there. I had a big problem just cutting down these clips. A bit more of a typical episode, I think it would go well with Fish Out of Water in the canon.
Okay, Kirk picked this from our list of submissions. So Kirk, why don't you start?
Okay, this is definitely one of my all-time favorite episodes of BoJack Horseman, a show I love and have watched multiple times. This one always stands out to me for so many reasons. A lot of them were already elucidated in detail, which is nice and saves me some work. One thing I love about this episode is there are so many good just running jokes and jokes happening in the background, which is one of the things I love about BoJack Horseman in general. There's, I think, a deer in arrears when Wanda loses it over that is great. There's the fight, which we couldn't see in that clip, in the jello pool where they're fighting and they keep falling into the jello pool and then getting out of the jello pool and having that fight is really great. So I like just all of the little jokes that are sort of going on through the episode. And, you know, I kind of agree that the bit with Wanda and BoJack is the weakest part. The mulch joke I thought was cute the first time and then, I don't know, less good the second time. In its defense, I will say I think the animation on those little, like, the vignettes when she's telling the stories are really funny, especially Brandon, the boyfriend, is like this roided out dog who's super mad at his girlfriend and is really funny looking. And also, I think it sets up something that happens with Wanda and BoJack a little later. When they finally break up, it's sort of this really heartbreaking line as she says, "What happened?" And he's like, "Well, the same thing that always happens. You fell in love with me and then you got to know me." And it's kind of setting up BoJack's fear that anyone who gets to know him will leave him, and they're moving in, and he's thinking, she doesn't know me, we're moving in together, I'm just setting myself up for this. But I do think that's the weakest part. And then last, I think the strongest clearly is the way that it explores Diane and Mr. Peanut Butter. I feel like in a way the show hadn't really before. And so my take on them is this. basically everybody on that show, or all the main characters, are just people for the most part, even the ones who are animals, except for Mr. Peanut Butter. And I've always kind of seen him as the only one who's an actual kind of a cartoon character more than anybody else. He's just more ridiculous than, you know, than anybody. Like, BoJack is basically just a dude. Princess Carolyn is basically just this lady. And then Mr. Peanut Butter is much more of a caricature. But in this episode, you kind of get a feel for how their relationship works anyways, because it's this sort of really relatable, multi-layered disagreement that then also just has so many good little jokes mixed in. There's another thing we couldn't see during one of those clips is that when Diana's they're having the fight on top of the fight about the Tony Curtis thing. She's popping balloons as she goes through the party. And every time she does, Mr. Peanut Butter kind of yips because he's a dog. And then there's some really good jokes about that later, too. Like when she says, Mr. Peanut Butter, you know, I love you and I think you're a good dog. Yes, you are. Yes, you are. And I love your fuzzy face or something like that. Or he's describing how when she goes to work, he just sits there on the couch. And sometimes he pretends to dig a hole, but he just doesn't do anything all day. And then when she gets home, he's so excited. He just goes insane. Like all of that just... I love that exploration of their relationship. It's weird in a way that would only make sense in the BoJack universe because he's more dog-like than a lot of the other characters are like their animal selves. Yes. But it still works and it makes the characters make sense to me. And they also make fun of Prairie Home Companion a lot. And that was also pretty funny.
I don't understand how Paul F. Tompkins is getting less voiceover work than Chris Parnell. Who is everywhere.
He's incredible. I agree.
He's great.
He's so good.
Like that should be flipped because he is amazing. And you get the sense that he just comes in, he does it. You know, he may change a little bit, but he's like such a quick comic mind.
Yeah.
He's got to be a natural for almost like any gig you got out there.
Mm-hmm. I get that feeling too. Mr. Peanut Butter is my favorite on the show. My girlfriend and I actually a lot of times, I feel like a lot of couples will talk about themselves in relation to Diana and Mr. Peanut Butter. And one of the things we watch this show a lot, and just when Diana's first explaining the fight over Tony Curtis and she says, Tony Curtis is dead. And you said, is he? And I said, yeah. And you said, I'm not sure. Just that is he is such a thing that people say. And we say that all the time. And it's always with this sort of knowing reference to BoJack. And it's thanks to this episode.
But that's such a Paul F. Tompkins line read on that, too. Like, that's how he.
Exactly.
Does. Yes.
I clipped that for you because I know you you wanted it. So here's that.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
Do you want to talk about what happened?
What happened? No, I don't want to talk about what happened. I just want to clean up.
Okay.
Why? What do you think happened?
I just...
Because what I think happened is that BoJack's girlfriend asked what Tony Curtis was up to, and I said, Tony Curtis died. And you said, did he?
Right,
and I said, yes, he did. And you said, really? I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I am. And you said, I'm not so sure. Uh-huh. And I said, I'm telling you, Tony Curtis is dead. And you said, let's check the internet.
No, I know,
and I said, we don't need to check the internet. I'm telling you, he's dead. And you said, let's just check, though. Is that what you think happened?
It's so relatable. I feel like everyone has probably had that kind of an argument. And also, I've totally done that to people. And without realizing that I was sort of like undermining someone in front of everybody else by doing that, and that I should just trust that they knew and that could be annoying. And I also like that Todd elsewhere in the episode, he says to Princess Caroline, I don't want to start a fight, but is he dead? And that kind of becomes, in the style of this show, a recurring thing. People will say, is he or did he? And I really like that.
Yeah.
Oh, I have had that exact fight with my husband. We weren't married yet. It was about Farrah Fawcett, and I won a dollar bet, and that dollar has been on the front of three different refrigerators now. Note in Sharpie.
I know things.
From me that was like, fear me, but yeah, I know things. I am not a regular BoJack watcher, but I think I'm going to have to become one. There are so many... like just little throwaway, like the whole visual of Vincent, like with his Velcro sneakers, and then when he makes the, you know, adult version of himself, and like there's a mannequin hand and then the broom.
Also played by Alison Brie really well, I think.
Oh, is it? God. I thought it was June Diane Raphael.
Oh, I thought it was Alison Brie, but maybe I'm wrong.
Is it? I'm not confident.
Is it? It might be. Yeah, one of us needs to look it up now. Oh no.
Dollar bets, folks, dollar bets. That whole sequence, like I was in the tank for this, for the canon, just based on the, we must do kisses to each other, Todd, line, line reading at just Todd's face. And he's like, okay, that's Aaron Paul, I think. And he's so good. Phoebe as the owl, obviously amazing, which he has to be like, I'm an owl. That he's like, you can't see that far in the dark. She's like, really? And how matter of fact he is about the cake. Like, how do they do that? I can't believe they baked Sir Paul McCartney into a cake. And he's just very like, barely even thinking about it. He's like, no, you bake the cake first and then Sir Paul McCartney gets inside.
right. And he needs to have that explained.
But when I was a kid, I thought they baked him into the cake somehow.
Same.
Yeah.
And I still would have questions about that, but she's like content with that explanation.
How do you get into cake without messing up the cake at all? Like, how does that work? Like, beyond it, like a Tom Cruise.
He gets out of the cake also. The animation where he hops out of the cake is really impressive. I was like, he's going to mess that cake up. And then
it's actually
because
him.
It's a cartoon.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was actually him. That is also.
But I was like, okay, now here's the test. A, they're going to call this back right before the end. And B, is it actually going to be Sir Paul McCartney? Yes to both. And as a result, yes from me. The running gag about Prairie Home Companion, people are just like, then lunch turned off.
Except I am.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah.
Kirk is right.
It was really enjoyable.
Sorry. I'm done. Over from here. Kirk is right. It was Alison Brie. I was wrong. Kirk is smart.
The multi-talented Alison Brie.
She is. This is great. I actually disagree that the BoJack Wanda part is the weakest. I think Wanda was a very sweet character, and I love the long, long payoff of the joke that she tells. I think is great. And I agree with Kirk that the animation on that sort of storybook looking animation
and the weird goofy music is so
good. is really funny and really adds to it. The art on this show is so well considered always, and the character design and, you know, the jokes that we can't hear, obviously, like happy birthday, Diane, and use a pretty font. I mean, the fact that is still funny somehow, even
and that's such
women,
a, and it's
so
another
much.
Good running joke in the show. They always have those signs. The Mr. Peanut Butter's sign company just does not understand what he's going for.
And his t-shirt printing company, we find out in this episode as well. And I also agree with Kirk that that Mr. Peanut Butter being the most animal-ish of the main characters really served this episode well, and the what he already quoted of Diane saying that he's such a good dog and she loves his funny face. Perfect. I very much related to that as well. You know, this is part of why their relationship works on one level is that he's just very loyal to her, and also why it doesn't work is that she can't handle that, which will continue to be a running issue for the two of them over the course of the many seasons. But yeah, it's an excellent episode. It's very complex. I was curious how Sarah would take the Vincent adult man part because she has no context for it. But then as the longer it went on, I was like, knowing more about their past relationship wouldn't add to this. It's so stupid.
Pretty much the whole joke is encapsulated in the scene, right? I mean,
pretty much,
he's very clearly a child, two children in a trench coat, and she doesn't get it. And that's
I mean, it's like... be grown-ups, way that all of those lines are delivered with that like nasally little kid like stuffed up nose thing is so, I mean, like, it could, and you have to really give them credit because the way it's done and my not having context for it, like, it could be really gross, like it could just like fall over the line and just be fucked up and not cute. But it's just funny because he has a fucking broom for a hand and chocolate is everywhere and she's just guzzling gin and she's totally oblivious. And
I also
so
like that they never
on the
explain
right side of it.
They never explain who the other kid is. I don't think you ever learn who the second child is that's inside the Vincent Adultman costume.
Nope. Yeah. And yes, all of the details of him, you know, the braces with the different colored brackets, like it's so good. They've put so much thought into all of it. It's great. Excellent choice for an episode, Dave.
A couple things. You're talking about all the little doggy bits of Mr. Peanut Butter that he thinks a ballroom is a room full of balls and not a place where you dance. I did want to highlight one piece of music which I thought was so spot on. I hope I have the right clip because I had to kind of cut the clip separately then put them into the user submission. But when Todd is first discovering that the phones in the car love each other and talking to each other, there's a bed of music that is so 1970s technology educational film under bed that goes with it. I'm going to play that clip. Hopefully I managed to excise the right one. Here we go.
Todd?
Yes, phone?
Are we in love?
Oh, no,
Todd's phone, but I am in love.
And then later on, it gets a little more synthy and stuff. But it was like such a perfect musical note. I mean, it's
very look around you.
It is. Yeah, it's totally of that era. Yeah, it's sort of early 80s kind of thing. You can imagine sort of the Sears laser portrait animations playing in the background. Very sort of like if Omni had a TV show, that would be their theme music. This is a really
well played,
funny episode. I'm glad when it first started with the flash forwards and flashbacks, I thought it was going to be a Rashomon episode. I'm glad it wasn't because I'm so sick of Rashomon episodes. I also agree that I kind of enjoyed Wanda as a character, you know, as a bit of harsh reality for BoJack, just kind of calling everything as it is. I thought the weakest part of the episode was the deer bit in the woods, and the submitter kind of like glossed right through that. And I think that's right. Like, I think that was a little spot on. But like the Vincent adult med stuff was so stupid. And I kind of thought at the time it went on too long, but then like it kind of turned a corner, which is like, all right, what next? I was going pee and then my dad heard me go pee and then he had to go pee. Like, so
speaking of pee, could I have some water? And she's like,
I think it was well described that Vincent Adultman is always kind of just enough Vincent Adultman. And I believe that's the last episode with him too. It's when she breaks up with him. And it's just never too much. It's just sort of this little gag that they do and they don't ever quite overdo. Which I feel like that show is generally like it's a strength of that show that they don't overdo anything.
Yeah. And I think that sort of is one of the, what do they do? 10 episodes, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
And 30 or 25 minute episodes. Yeah.
Like as opposed to like, you know, like something like The Simpsons, you know, where they're doing 25 episodes a year, like, you know, that there's burnout, you know, whereas here, you know, you get a reasonable number, you get to do your stuff and you get to craft the episodes that you get. I mean, we have said so many times on this podcast, you know, we've said like all TV shows need shorter seasons. And, you know, this is kind of proof that you can write something very tight and you can take care with all your characters when you don't have to fucking rush everything and have, you know, a writer's room of 30 people. You can just have like 6 or 7 doing.
Especially, man, I can't imagine anyone not feel, I feel really like full. I don't know if that's the right word after watching a whole season of BoJack, just because like Arrested Development or like any of those really dense comedies, I'll go back and rewatch this show. And I just, even rewatching this episode, which I've seen like 3 or 4 times for this show, I felt like I saw 8 new jokes and visual gags. Yeah. The lion with a thorn in his paw waiting in the waiting room. But there's so many little jokes like that on this show that if it's that rich, it doesn't need to be long.
No, it's true.
Not only BoJack's rich in that Arrested Development way, it also kind of has, you know, some emotional punch to it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's dealing with a lot of sort of heavy subjects and dealing with them pretty well. You know, I was kind of bagging on Crazy Ex-Girlfriend a couple of weeks ago for that. But I think this show does a much better job of dealing with sort of feelings of inadequacy and depression born from that and sort of getting into a spiral you can't really ever get yourself out of. I think that it helps that this is an animated show and your self-defenses drop somewhat, you know, when something's animated. Mm-hmm. And so when they deal with this kind of stuff, I feel like it has more of a direct line to your brain than say watching a live action show.
Good point.
So I think that's part of it, but also that, you know, they allow the characters to really kind of say what they're thinking in the moment, and sort of that weird sort of self exposition works in this show. They can get away with that in an animated show, where I think in another show it might seem a little heavy handed. I think it makes it all the more effective. So, you know, you've got that really goofy stuff, but you got the really kind of serious stuff happening at the same time, and they balance it so well that it seems effortless and powerful. So I'm continually impressed by this show. And I think the submitter is right. You know, the last canon submission we had for this episode was the fish out of water one, which is the almost speech, textless, you know, dialogueless episode that takes place in the underwater city. And this is sort of like more typical as far as the structure and character pairings and all that go, but, you know, no less effective in what it's trying to do. So shall we put this to a official vote?
Let's do.
Okay. Tara Ariano, what say you?
I vote yay.
Kirk, what say you?
I definitely vote yay.
Sarah D. Bunting.
I also vote yay.
All right. That makes it a sweep. So I'll say yes to. That means BoJack Horseman Season 2, Episode 4. It's called After the Party. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for Winner and a Loser Leak. Take it away, Tara.
Kim Kardashian, she is reported, was just announced just last week that she earns three times what her husband, Kanye West, does. Make that paper, girl.
Hold on. I'll let you continue in a minute. But Kanye West.
No, I see what you're doing. I got it. It took me a minute, though. Yeah.
That's it. She makes a lot of money. Good for her.
Yeah, sure.
I have this week's loser, making less money, Jessica Capshaw and Sarah Drew, abruptly fired from Grey's Anatomy. Although Grey's Anatomy claims that it was always planned, it was not abrupt. Then Deadline made it weird by sort of like subtweeting in their piece about the ousters a link between their departures and Ellen Pompeo's big payday. And then they had to update it by making it clear that there was no relationship and they're sorry for any confusion. And
oh, Deadline.
Yeah.
What were they doing? Were they like fishing for some source to give them more information?
I don't think so. What they got was, how dare you from all parties.
Okay. So just a miscalculated tweet then.
Yeah. That they're like, could you maybe stop hammering on that? Like, well... I guess not. So we'll link to it in the show notes, but there's an update to the piece in which they have to walk that back. So anyway,
oops.
Good luck, Sarah Drew. Loved you and Everwood.
Speaking about wishing people good luck, do you know what time it is? It's game time.
Oh!
Game time theme, another Kirk Hamilton original.
Woo!
That's true. Wow. Memories.
This is the sixth game time of the season. Not to put any pressure on you, Kirk, but here are the standings. Valued guests have 4 points. That's 1 point away from clinching a season victory.
Oh, no.
Tara has one. Sarah has zero.
Sarah won last week. Sarah has one. I have zero.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Perfectly understandable mistake.
Oh, that's right.
No, it's not. It's rude. Dave, get your shit together.
I'm sorry. Sarah won on her quality of her sound effects. I forgot.
That's right.
My apologies. Meowing. I am sorry. So the scores are value guess 4, Sarah 1, Tara 0. Today we are playing Before and After yet again from Mr. Dan Cassina, who earns himself an extra credit. Redeemable for an extra hot great minute topic of his choosing whenever they return, hopefully shortly. All right. So here's how this works. We have played it before. I will give you a synopsis of a TV show that is born out of a mashup of two other TV shows. You have to give me that mashup name. So, for example, forgettable must-see TV sitcom about a morning show that brings on Crockett and Tubbs to boost ratings.
Good morning, Miami Vice.
Good Morning Miami Vice would be the name of that show. Yes. That's how that goes. We have about 27 questions, I think. But before we get into the order, let's hear what the steel meal situation is from Tara Ariano.
No one has any steel meals.
All right. That makes it easy. All right. Let's throw it to Picky to see who's going to go first. Picky, come on. Get with it.
We will start with Tara.
All right, so our order today is going to be Tara, then Kirk, then Sarah. Are we ready to play Before and After yet again?
Yes.
Sir. Okay. Sure.
Tara Ariana, When a father is imprisoned, a reformed fake psychic con man has to come back to California to hold his family together.
Oh, no.
When a father is imprisoned.
Yeah.
A former fake psychic con man has to come back to California to hold his family together.
I don't know.
Oh, no.
I don't know.
That is Arrested Developmentalist.
I'm stuck on psych.
All right, Kirk, okay. here's your first question.
Okay.
Steve Austin finds himself in an alternate reality where Nazis won World War II and are occupying America.
Oh, man. I know one of these, but I don't know if I know the other one.
Steve Austin, not the wrestler. Not the wrestler, Steve Austin.
Oh, I was thinking Stone Cold Steve Austin. The man in the high tower castle. I don't know.
That is the $6 million man in the high castle.
Oh, that's the other Steve Austin. Of course.
All right, Sarah D. Bundy can take the lead with this. Her first question. An unnamed dealer delivers pot to young versions of Abraham Lincoln, Joan of Arc, Gandhi, and others.
Clone high maintenance.
Yeah.
Dang, nice.
Would watch.
Sorry, Ariana.
Same.
An ancient warrior who can speak to animals gets over a breakup by learning how to make pasta and goes to Thanksgiving with his girlfriend.
Beastmaster Chef?
Beastmaster of None.
Oh.
All right, back to Kirk. An underwater detective in a noir-styled city has to deal with morons who fall for online identity scams.
Oh, man. An underwater detective.
Yes.
I have no idea. It's a hard one.
That is Catfish Police. Catfish
Police. Oh, okay. All right.
I was on SpongeBob. I couldn't get to it.
Sarah D. Bunting. Fourth wall breaking 14-year-old girl tells the audience about a certain working class bigot.
Fourth wall breaking 14-year-old girl
tells the audience about a certain working class bigot.
Clarissa explains it all in the family.
Yes.
Oh, wow. I'm impressed.
Kara.
I'm exhausted.
Yes.
An edgy Las Vegas street magician uses Dungeons and Dragons to make friends in high school.
Chris Angel Mind Freaks and Geeks.
Oh, man.
All right, Kirk.
Quality. Okay.
Immoral, fourth wall breaking, power hungry president as his personality replaced nightly in order to better complete missions for his mysterious overlords.
Oh, Dollhouse of Cards. Yes.
Nice.
Sarah, an overweight family man, Michael Wiseman, is killed by a train, his brain transplanted into a perfect body, and he's tasked with making spot-on spoofs of popular nonfiction programs.
Yeah,
I'm gonna give you a little additional hint because the wording is a little misleading.
Okay.
After overweight family man, Michael Wiseman is killed by a train. His brain is transplanted into a perfect body, and he's tasked with making spot-on spoofs of documentaries.
Documentary Now and Again?
Sarah.
Oh, very good.
All right, Ariana.
Muscle.
Yes.
Good luck. Popular recent anime series in which giant humanoid aliens are fought off by an orphan girl in the 19th century Maritimes. If you get this, I'm giving you 5 Dave points.
The only one I know is that one we did for that weird cannon.
No,
I can't remember what it's called.
Oh, no.
Although it does seem like that
with an E? I have no idea.
That is Attack on Titan and with an E.
Oh.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. All right.
Dan.
Back to Kurt. Mike, that's in quotes, Quinn leaves Chicago Springs to solve homicides with Angie Harmon and friends.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Angie Harmon. I don't know.
That's a deep cut. That's a tough one.
That is a deep cut.
Yeah. That is Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman's Murder Club. Gosh, all right. Sarah D. Bunting. Weirdly, everyone who comes to the island just wants to meet a Sleestak. Let me just give you I'm going to reword that this one on the fly as well. Weirdly, everyone who comes to the island just wishes to meet a Sleestak.
Fantasy Island of the Lost?
Correct.
Bang.
All right, Tara Ariano.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, let's do a score break right now.
Okay. Kirk and I are tied with one each. Sarah has four.
Oh, Sarah, take
Sarah's
it away.
Killing it.
Yep.
All right. This is, there is no equalizer challenge zones because we are short on time today. Tara Ariano.
Yep.
An 800-year-old vampire working as a detective in Toronto decides to kidnap Mick Jagger.
Forever Knights of Prosperity.
Yes.
Nice.
That's pretty good. All right. For Kirk, a detective played by James Gardner is hired to find the long missing Uncle Traveling Matt, in quotations.
Oh, man. I don't know.
You know any part of that?
No. Oh. I was trying to think what the detective one could be, but no.
That is Fraggle Rockford Files.
Oh.
Sarah D. Bunting. Robert Stack or Dennis Farina host a true crime show in which all of the reenactments star Deborah Messing. Robert Stack or Dennis Farina hosts a true crime show in which all of the reenactments star Deborah Messing.
Shit.
Sarah.
What the? I know, but what was the other one? The only answer I have in my head is Unsolved Gray Stories. That is not it. Give me a moment.
What would it have been?
Unsolved Mysteries of Laura. Sarah DeBunte.
Oh, the mysteries of
Laura. Mom, cop, mom.
We're not all obsessed with her fucking vegan Instagram. I'm sorry that I forgot the mysteries of Laura. I wish you
John would have gotten that one. Poor John.
All right.
Yeah, fuck him.
Back to Tara. News yes. producer Katie has enough problems dealing with anchor Will McBoy's constant mansplaining, and now her mother takes a job as an intern.
Great newsroom.
Correct. This is question number 17.
Spread Eagle.
Immortal New York homicide detective grapples with Glenn Close's immoral litigator.
Oh, man. Okay. Glenn Close's immoral litigator is going to be... Wait, is that damages? Or is that the other one? And an immortal detective.
Yes. And we've already used up Forever Night.
Well, Luke Cage isn't really a detective, and he's not immortal. Angel was a detective, but he is, I guess, not technically immortal. I don't know. I feel close, but not there.
Anybody?
New Amsterdamages.
Yes.
Oh, there it is. Okay, New Amsterdam. All right.
Sarah D. Bunting. In order to better preserve the culture he grew up in, Anthony Anderson makes a bunch of clones of himself.
Orphan Blackish?
Correct. This is question. For Tara. When her husband dies, Mina Harker brings in old friends Dorian Gray and Frankenstein's creature. No, actually, it was Frankenstein. To help her raise her kids.
Penny Dreadful House.
Penny Dreadful House.
Kirk.
Excellent.
Chicagoan? Is that what they call them? I guess so, right?
Chicagoan?
Yeah, yeah.
Chicagoan, maybe.
Chicagoan Larry has to deal with his wacky cousin from the Upside Down.
Oh, Perfect Stranger Things.
Yeah. Nice.
All right. Number 21, after which we'll get the scores again. Manny Scott Baio stars in this 90s General Hospital spinoff.
Oh, Joe Reed, this one's for you. Port Charles in charge.
Of our days and our nights.
You did it, folks.
Score break, please.
All right. Well, Sarah is still killing it with 6 points. I have 4. Kirk has 2.
All right. There is a possibility for a tie end game. Everybody has 2 questions left.
Oh, boy.
So, Tara, you got to get them all. Sarah, you got to miss them all.
Won't be a problem. Hit me.
Well, Sarah, you don't have to miss them all. I'm just saying.
I know. I know I don't have to. It's just what I do.
Tara Arrieta.
Yes.
Sarah, you got to believe in yourself.
You were the one who saying she's got to miss them all.
Yeah, you're going to lose. All right, Tara.
Jesus Christ.
This is some good, like, reverse forward psychology happening right
Jesus
now.
Jesus Christ.
You're the worst coach we ever had.
Can we just get this over with, please?
Tara Arrieta. Brett Michaels.
Yes.
Brett Michaels, a cruise ship, a bunch of women, and Isaac Manning open a bar. What could go wrong?
Rock of Love Boat.
Rock of Love Boat. Kirk Douglas. Matthew Perry plays a sports talk radio host who joins a support group with Killface and Awesome X.
Oh man, Killface. Wait a minute, what's Killface? Matthew Perry plays a this isn't the one Sorkin show, because he was not a radio announcer in that. I don't know, I feel like I should know this one, but I don't.
Anybody?
I can't remember what that show was called.
It's Frisky Dingoan.
Ah, Killface, that's it. Frisky Dingoan. Ugh. Yeah. I never watched that show.
Alright, Sarah D. Bunting. Beleaguered father John Ritter finds that he can experience the sensations of parents all over the globe.
Parents all over the globe. Since 8 Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter. I don't remember the actual title.
It's so close, Sarah. Show.
You got to give it to her for that. Oh, my God.
Yeah, that was good enough, I think. I think so.
Does he? What's the actual title?
Simple.
I'm going to
reserve.
I don't know, guys. There's so much. All right, fine. Sense 8 Simple Rules for Dating
simple
My Teenage
rules.
Daughter.
Excuse me.
Now, I felt pressure to give you that point. I just want to say that. Tara Arrieta.
Cool.
Yes.
Maybe tomorrow he'll settle down. Until tomorrow, this depressed anthropomorphized horse will just keep moving on.
The Littlest Hope Bojack Horseman.
All right, Kirk, here's your last question. Conspiracy theorist Andre Brower and his friends face middle age.
Oh, man. I only know Andre Brower from Brooklyn Nine-Nine, so I'm afraid I'm stuck on this one.
Yeah, you're not going to get it with Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Anybody want to take a guess at that?
Men of a Certain Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
Nope.
Oh.
The Lone Gunmen of a Certain Age.
Oh, sure.
Okay,
all right, here's our last question, Sarah D. Bunting. Abe Lincoln's sassy butler moves to California and celebrates Chrismukkah.
And Dan Rogge, this one's for you, provided I get it right, which I may not, but I believe this is the O Secret Life of Desmond Pfeiffer.
Again, you're one word off. I feel
Diary?
Like, yes.
Secret.
There, clean win.
Nice.
All right, that, Sarah takes the game, but I have a tiebreaker. We're going to play for shits and giggles and a steel meal, all right?
Ooh.
So I will read the clue. First person to shout out the correct answer wins. If you shout out and you get it wrong, you have to wait till everybody else has their turn before you can shout out a second answer. All right?
Yep. Okay.
And just for the record, if you get one word wrong in this tiebreaker, the answer is not correct. Here we go.
James Franco travels back in time to stop the assassination of Jack Tripper.
November 22nd, 1963's Company.
You are
nice.
Correct.
So now, do you guys say the name of that is November 22nd, 1963 and not 11-22-63?
Oh, I don't know.
I don't know. I'm just going to be the still worst works. Here at the very end.
Okay,
convince
that's
me.
Fine. I accept that.
Sarah.
Look, what Kirk says goes.
Nice.
He is the guy who came up with the game time theme. So there, no, I'm just joking. You have one steel mill. We're going to give you that. You know, the world.
I already crossed it off. It's fine.
The world. I was joking. The world cannot agree on date formats. You got the European ones. You got kind of that metric ones. You got the American
ones. That's a good
ones.
Point. I was just looking at a European version of that book and the numbers are in a different order.
Yeah. There you go. Well, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We investigated the second series of Jessica Jones before going around the dial with stops at Champions, Altered Carbon, and The Good Fight. We put Kirk on the spot to discover if the theme to Is This Worse Than Jazz was worse than jazz. And Lauren completed our successful first back-to-back canon submissions with another successful entry for BoJack Horseman's After the Party. We crowned winners and losers of the week. And Sarah was the winner of this week's Game Time. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano.
Relax, Brandon.
Sarah D. Bunting.
This is a joke about nature.
And Kirk Hamilton.
You should never, never put Jell-O in your pool.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next time, right here. Extra.
I agree.
I gotta go.
Bye, Super Lady.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv podcast network.
It is funny to think of you being on the show for the first time and yet having been on the show dozens and dozens
right,
and dozens
right.
of times.
You know, I say this a lot about I play a sax solo at the beginning of Split Screen of our podcast theme music. And it's this like really cheesy, like, you know, 90210 theme saxophone solo. And I feel like I bet that now more people have heard that saxophone solo than every other saxophone right. solo I've played in my life combined. And it's sort of a mortifying
have you
thing to think about.
Heard of the show Nightman?
Like Dayman Nightman?
No, not Sunny Philadelphia. No, this is a comic book from the 90s called Nightman. They turned into a TV starring a character called Johnny Domino.
Okay.
Who
good name.
Turns up the heat every night at the House of Soul. He's in San Francisco, saxophone jazz player, and also by night a superhero.
What? How have I never heard of this? This sounds so up my
totally,
alley.
I'm,
you tried it.
My theory is they're the same person.
this is all I've
seen Kirk Hamilton and Nightman in the same room together.
It's true.